Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. I thank you so much for joining us. I thank you every time because if you're tuning in, whether it be the radio broadcast, the podcast, or the video cast, you're taking time out of your day. I just got the latest for the month of March from, I guess it was YouTube, and 343 some odd listens and over 2,000, I don't think it was hours. They do it in minutes, which is, I guess it's so that it looks more impressive to you. Over 2,400 minutes. I'm not even going to try to divide by 60, but be that as it may, I thank you so much for tuning in. We've got a wonderful program for you. And as I mentioned, of course, we broadcast these programs on Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m., Wednesdays at 9 a.m. for our special edition of Tell Me Your Story. And then we're here Monday through Friday from 8 to 9 a.m. That is nine programs. It is nine interviews. It's nine subjects, nine guests, nine opportunities for you to hear something that maybe you haven't heard before, or maybe you have. And when our guests bring up the subject and talk about the different aspects for the first time, or maybe the 12th time, it clicks and you go, oh yeah, my wife, my brother, my mom, my friend used to say that all the time. That makes sense. Well, we hope that you're doing that. We are also streaming live at those times at richarddugan.com. The podcasts are on SoundCloud, iTunes, TuneIn Radio, Spotify, Stitcher, Player FM, Blueberry, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, and many other locations. And you can watch these interviews on YouTube. That's right, YouTube, where we are there. We hope that you will subscribe. We hope that you will click notifications so that when a new conversation is posted, that you will be able to listen in on that conversation. We hope you'll do that. We also ask that if you can support the work we're doing financially, we would be ever so grateful. We have a PayPal account. It is there for your security as well as ours. And the email address you're going to want to use when they ask, to whom are you sending? Richard@richarddugan.com. That's Richard@richarddugan.com. And let's see. Oh, one other thing. And we will probably get into this because it was probably part of the process our guests went through. We ask that you spend time during this, the decade of perfect vision, going within to that quiet, peaceful, calm, still place and listening to that still small voice. Well, today's program, I think you're going to enjoy. I know I am. I like talking with folks who, not because they've been through the challenges they've been through, but because of what they've learned. And then they come here to share what they've learned with us. Our program today has to do with a series of events, a journey. And the title of the book, by the way, that our guest has written is called Scarred. It's a feminist journey through pain. Came out last year. And it's, of course, available as an ebook, a paperback, and so forth. And, of course, we'll find out also if it's available in Audible. I hope it is. If not, we'll have to have a chat with her. And who is she? Dr. L. Iu Saraswati. She's the author of Scarred. Welcome. And as you've shared with me, all the way from Hawaii.
Yes, thank you. And thank you again for allowing me to share this space with you and with the audience as well. I really appreciate it.
Well, you're very welcome. I love doing these programs and talking about these this wide variety of subjects. And I know that the subject, especially of feminism, which isn't necessarily the direction that we will be going per se, but I was born and raised into a family with five females and two other males. And I found it fascinating as I grew and it became more and more aware, not within the family, mind you, but out in the real world, if you can call it that, the disparity between men and women, males and females, the masculine and the feminine. And I always love to use this particular example. In the Bible, the gender that first recognized who the risen Christ was not Peter, supposedly, The Rock and the first Pope. It was Mary Magdalene, who, by the way, went to touch his garment. I jokingly say, he said, no, 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 no. The paint's not dry yet. Don't touch. Whereas the guys were wandering, going, came across him, going, hey, buddy, can you show us where the nearest tavern is? We got to drown our sorrows. Our best friend just died. And I just look at that going, okay, whoever compiled this book made a tactical error, because they gave credit to the one gender the last thing they wanted to do was give credit to. And I find that it's like, wait a minute, do you understand that you came from a woman, your mother? And also, but from a biological standpoint, from what I remember from biology in school, we all started out female. It wasn't until the DNA kicked in and made the decision, oh, this one's going to be male. Nope, this one will stay female. I find that as far as the universe is concerned, especially on a metaphysical level, that to me is fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Share with us your understanding of what feminism is.
So feminism used to be about women's equality to men. But that was sort of like more like the earlier women's movement, because later on, obviously, people realized that there were inequality among men. There were inequality among women. So it cannot just be about asking equality between the sexes, because obviously there are like different inequalities that exist through race, class, able-bodied status, mental health status. And so now I think feminism is more about social justice across the board kind of issue. And more than anything, it's not about sameness, because a lot of time people sort of think that, oh, we want to be the same as men. We want to be the same as this. But it is about access. And it's about equal access. And in my book, I talk about democratizing access to well-being. So it's sort of like that in some way. It's about having all of these access available to you, affordable to you, if you want to access them, right? So it doesn't mean that, oh, I want to be exactly like that person. I want to be exactly like that. Does that make sense, the difference? Like, it's about having the possibilities to be able to learn this, even though you don't have money, right? Rather than, oh, because my family is not rich and therefore we can't even go to college, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. I've also, in conversations with folks about this subject, and that is that when it comes to feminism and when it comes to equity, if you will, women are not wanting to take over. They are wanting to share in the process. Big difference.
Yeah. And we're not even here yet, let alone to like want to do that. And I think with the current challenges as well, it has been getting harder and harder, or more challenging to be, you know, female biologically, or in terms of one's identity as well. And so I think it's really about looking at all of these, you know, social issues, and really understanding how can we support one another. And so in the book, for example, I talk about, it's not that if you do all these four things, then you'll be free from pain. Like, that's definitely not the promise that I offer in the book. But actually, the premise of the book is that we will, and we are, and we have been living with pain. Sometimes it manifests in this way, sometimes it manifests in that way. But the idea then, if we have to live with pain, right, mm-hmm. then how do we live with pain in a way that is more life-sustaining, in a way that is more humane, right? In a way that is more enchanting and even social justice oriented. So it's not just about me, 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 me all the time. It's not about How can I get rid of my pain? But it's about collective pain, right? And how can we together create this environment that is more life-sustaining for you? Even though, because we all know, unless you can challenge that, we're all gonna die. I don't know how we're gonna die, but we're all gonna do that. But in the process, how can we make this life more life-sustaining for everyone, not just for me?
Yeah, I remember a comedian, and I want to say it was probably back in the 80s, by the name of Tim Allen. And I thought he had a very funny routine where he talked about, guys, that kind of thing. And he got a lot of blowback because people thought he was being anti-woman. And it's like, are you watching the same guy I am? Because I don't get that. And what he was talking about back then was, there are times when guys need to spend time with guys. It's just part, and women are the same way. They need to have those bonding moments. My present wife, wanted to do something very special for my mother and my sisters, who I'm not sure if at the time they were all mothers, but they are now. And she wanted to, at on Mother's Day, wanted to throw a little soiree for them. I even have pictures of the table that she laid out, and we had the brunch outside and so on and so forth. And it was beautiful, and it was a wonderful experience for them. I was the waiter. I was actually allowed to stay that much. But this was a time not only for, in this case, relatives to connect together, but for women to spend some time together. So the genders, they need that, don't they? They need those experiences. My father used to go out into the desert with a couple of his buddies, who we kids used to refer to as uncles. They weren't in our lineage or our family tree, but they were very good friends. And they'd go out in the desert, smoke cigars, drink beers. I don't know what else they did out there for like a weekend. And it was just part of the process. How important is that?
Well, first of all, that is not my area of study, so I cannot
I
answer that
understand.
on the study or anything like that. But to me, I don't want to what people call essentializing, meaning that if you are born a certain way or born with certain genitalia, then you'll behave in this way, if that makes sense. And so there will be people, like you said, who are born with certain genitalia and have a certain gender expression, and they behave a certain way. And I think, again, a lot of the misconception about feminism is that we are all about, oh, you have to do this. We have to challenge all this. Like, everybody has to live this way. Actually, no. Like, what we want is to liberate, everyone from this sort of like gender prescription, right? Meaning that if you have this genitalia, you have to have this gender, you have to behave in this way. These are the kinds of thing that you want to do. Does that make sense? And so for some people, if this works for you, then by all means, that's great, right? You found like how it is that is more life sustaining for you. And for other, they may need, like you said, more feminine energy in their life, even though they identify as male, assigned male at birth, but they really want that. And so it is about, to me anyway, again, as you know, there are like different understanding of feminism, and even among feminists, they have different ways of approaching things, and that's great. And that's what we learn actually at school as well. That there are these different strands of feminism. Sometimes they focus more on the environment, sometimes they focus more on the economy, and so it is really about, to me anyway, liberating these sort of shackles that sort of bound us with just this body or these rules. I think to me that, because I think it's more liberating, because sometimes, like you said, you probably want time with your partner, with your family, or with other buddies, so to speak. And so And I do think that we probably, for me anyways, I need all kinds of times with all kinds of people. And depending on the mood, again, returning to my book, in one of the chapters, I talk about how often do we actually listen to the body and ask, what do I want to do right now? Because like you said, sometimes it's about going out in the desert. Sometimes it's about having like spa day. And it could be spa day today. It could be something else tomorrow. But how often do we really ask our body and listen to it? And a lot of the time, even myself too, I doubt it. I ask my body, but my body's not telling me what to do. And again, the question, have you been practicing listening to your body? Because if you haven't really asked, and then suddenly you just want to ask and be given the answer, it's sort of like, I don't know, like you never asked me before, what's this?
I love that. I'm curious, and this, you, of course, a doctor. You teach. You're a professor in the areas of women and gender and sexuality studies there at the University of Hawaii. Would you say that even though we are focusing predominantly on the issue of women, and in this context, women and feminism and so forth, in the context of this multifaceted book called Scarred. Would you say that the same, how do I put it? Principles is one word, but processes, shall we say, in a general sense, work both for men and women in terms of basically what you've just said, that, nine times out of 10, men aren't listening to their bodies either. And I have a feeling that because that is part of the male stereotype, I'll put it that in that context, big boys don't cry, that maybe that's part of where there's that disconnect. I mean, the last thing that that a lot of real masculine men want to hear is you need to get in touch with your feminine side. Don't ever say that to a big burly fella. However, I've seen interviews with some big burly guys who they know the difference. They understand the importance and so forth. And again, I know this is not your area of expertise, but it seems to me that the rules ought to apply to both genders. Is that a fair assessment?
The gender limitations and stereotypes definitely affect all genders, like you said. And it is limiting for everyone. And that's why I think, even though in early years of the women's movement, it is about, like I said, creating this dichotomy and kind of like really putting this sort of, I don't want to use the word, let me think of like what would be the better word, kind of like antagonistic between these genders. And sort of like later women's or feminist movement, it is really about working together because we then realize when we talk about, let's say, men, they're also, like you said, being disadvantaged, being limited by all of these patriarchal rules and stereotypes and things. And so it is in everybody's best interest, obviously, to work together, right? Because then it is harmful for men to not be able, let's say, to cry, like you said, or to express their emotions, right? And so it is to the again, it is about the collective. It's not just about the individual. It's not just about a certain group of people, but it really is for everybody. And that's, I think, is for me the most important thing to clarify about feminism, so that people don't get that like what you said earlier, this sort of misconception that women then want to rule the world. Because again, then what we create will be just the flip side of what is going on, a male versus a female dominated world. And we've moved beyond that. We've moved beyond that. And so I think But again, how do we begin where we are, actually work together?
Yeah, it is. It's that element as well as the whole element that I have to say, I don't want to say that it necessarily disappeared, but it sure made its head known back in 2015, the whole concept of victimhood. And I'm going, no, I dealt with that back in my 20s when I was going through personal growth programs. No more. I refuse to play that game. And I think too, I also refuse to play the traditional relationship game in terms of the way the stereotypes. It's like that's not the world we live in anymore. And we can't, a lot of people want to go back to the way it was like in the 50s. And I'm thinking, well, you may want to go back there, but there were a lot of people who don't. It wasn't great for them at all. And the reality is we can't go back. So with this book, it seems to me, Scarred is sort of a an evolutionary journey for women in particular, but for our society as a whole, collectively, as you've mentioned. Can you talk a little bit about that and what you envision in this evolutionary process through sharing your story, which is sort of a combination of a memoir and it's referenced here, scholarly criticism. We'll get into that part later, but let's talk a little bit about the evolution of our society.
Yeah, so this book is based on my traveling to 20 countries in 1 year,
Wow.
to find healing or to have a better understanding of pain and healing. And because we live in society where we focus a lot on the individual. So, for example, when we have problems, when we have pain, people would advise us to, get a therapy, right? Or go to workshop, like you said, like work, you have to work on your pain, like literally workshop it. And then, but what we forget, and after sort of like going to this different countries, is that what will it look like if we consider pain again, not just, right, not just something that happens to us like personally or individually, but also it is something that happens because of the structure that we live in. So for an example, loneliness. When we feel alone or lonely, which are two different things, but in this case, I'm conflating the two, sometimes we feel like, oh, this just happens to me. I'm so bad at making friends. Right. So we blame ourselves. And so they say, hey, take this workshop, a weekend workshop, how to make friends, or read books about how to make friends, in like 10 seconds. But what I'm trying to also look at, so again, the word also, right? What I mean by that, I just want to be clear that I'm not saying no, it's not personal. What I'm saying it is personal, but also it's the collective. This loneliness may also come from the way that we structure our life. For example, the way that we live, a lot of the time we rent a one-bedroom apartment, we live alone, we rent a two-bedroom apartment, and then we live with one other person or with families, with our kids, which is different from if you live in an extended family. So even though you're single, for example, you may live with your parents, we may live with relatives, and it is not frowned upon because in our society, there might even be movies made about, your failure to launch if you still live with your parents, right? Without understanding that all of these changes that are happening contribute to this pain, contribute to this loneliness. So, in other words, rather than only looking at ourselves, oh, why can't I make friends? We also need to look at the structure. What is happening in the structure that creates this loneliness? Why is everybody on their phone? Again, not an attack on the phone. I have my phone next to my bed. But what is it about the structure of our society that creates this loneliness and that feeling of loneliness more palpable in our lives? So that's sort of like the takeaway. One of the main takeaways that I learned in my book is so that the first thing, the first step, or I have four practices that I offer in my book. The first practice is about shifting our perception. And that's what I mean. The shifting perception is not just about shifting from negative to positive thinking. No, because we know that. We've learned that. We've even become positive ourselves. And we think, wow, I like been practicing positive thinking. And why do I still feel this much pain? And so, this shift of perception that I want us to look at is looking from only that sort of personal, the individual, to this more sort of collective, more structural, more societal, which is the example that I pointed out today.
You know, you mentioned earlier your travels, 20 countries in a year.
Yes.
I have to say that the first thing that came to my mind was all you did was pack and unpack your bags for an entire year, just constantly packing and unpacking your bags. But
Absolutely. And luckily, I didn't have that many. So I travel very light. At the time, I travel only with carry-on and a personal item. So that was pretty much it that I had to pack and unpack.
Yeah. And I say that tongue in cheek, but obviously you had other things going on as well. By the way, folks, so we're talking with Ayu Saraswati, Dr. Ayu Saraswati, and the website, which we will be linked to, is Dr. Saraswati. That's DrSaraswati.com. It'll be a lot easier if you just click on the link at the podcast location and find out more about the work that she is doing, which I find fascinating. You know, it's real interesting too. I was just thinking about this in terms of our earlier part of our conversation. I was in recommended therapy near the end of my first marriage, and the therapist asked me to list put together a list of friends. 99% of them were female, and apparently there was a problem with that, according to the therapist. And during the therapy, sharing the bits and pieces of myself, at one point the therapist, who well, first of all, remain nameless and also remain unpaid,
Uh-oh.
said, made reference to her words, not mine. And isn't that also interesting? Female therapist. I had character flaws. Really? Why don't you just really just keep going down that road and continue to insult me? It was amazing to me. But when I looked at that, I'm thinking, first of all, I didn't really think there was a problem. I mean, I'm a guy, all right, and I'm attracted to women. One of my favorite jokes of a male comedian was, I'm gonna have to tell you folks, I'm gonna come out now and say that I'm a lesbian trapped in a man's body. That's how much I love women. I'm not saying that. That's what he said. But I find it interesting how unfortunately, the stereotypes within relationships in particular, which I hope is changing a little bit. Not so much that we still have stereotypes. I think we need to get rid of them. But that males in relationship, whether it be unmarried or married, or let's make it a context of committed, a committed relationship, and they have female friends, and supposedly there's supposed to be this tension between the committed people, because he has all these female friends. Like, well, wait a minute. I acquired, so to speak, these friends long before you ever came along, and they're not going anywhere. They're good friends. I work with them. I do, and so on and so forth. So to me, it's fascinating, and I know that you deal with the whole issue, as I said, as we said earlier, of gender, in particular, but also sexuality. And it seems to me that is also one of the big bugaboos we have in our society in particular. There are other cultures around the world. They don't have a problem. Matter of fact, they don't have a problem so much that apparently they did not get the edict from Adam and Eve to put on fig leaves and what have you, because they walk around naked or pretty much almost unclothed, I think is a better term. Whereas we in our society, we have a real problem with this. Do you see some changes in our relationship, our attitudes towards relationships, because I'm getting the message from some that a lot of these, I will say, stereotypes are part of the minority. The only reason why it seems like it's a bigger group is because they're in social media, they're in the media in general and so forth, and they have the loudest voice, but it's probably a very small percentage, that the majority of people are a heck of a lot more open-minded, and so on and so forth. I mean, when I got a divorce, my parents didn't disown me. My parents made it to 61 years before my father's passing. 61 years. And I looked at them as the example in my first marriage. And now I've been together with my second wife and my last, because I have no intention of going through that again. I've been with her for over 25 years. So are you seeing the dynamics shifting and changing, whether they're publicized or otherwise? Because you're going to have more contact with people on a private level, even in a school setting, than maybe I would out in public and so forth. What's your observation?
Absolutely. I think what is happening right now in our country is very fascinating, because it does seem like there is this sort of like polarized opposite, so to speak. As you mentioned, there are groups, exactly like what you've mentioned before, who want to sort of go back to more of a traditional sort of relationship. I think in the social media, we have this sort of the trad wife, so to speak, right? That mm-hmm. wants kind of go back to a particular specific historical period too, like what you mentioned. But again, because I teach women, gender, and sexuality studies, so the kind of students who come to my class, right, already and usually are more open and more open-minded about the kind of gender and sexuality that are happening in the United States. So I do see that there is this sort of like more openness toward different kinds of relationship, toward open relationship. I do see students coming into my class, and then when we, you know, talk about open relationship, and student would say, I am in open relationship, I am in this kind of, you know, polyamorous relationship. So I do see this kind of like different ways in which we relate to one another. And also, if marriage before was more seen as an economic unit, now people see marriage to more of an emotional rather than just economic unit, because as you also observe that more people can be out there in terms of the job or getting their job. And so they don't have to rely on their partner to, you know, feed them, so to speak. And so I think it is really, really fascinating to see, you know, like, are we even talking about the same kind of like society? Are we really sharing the same land and everything? Because I do see, you're absolutely right, that I think are more that changes are happening, and the desire to just kind of like get married and like have this sort of family the way that maybe their parents or their grandparents did it is also becoming later and later as well.
You know, I'm not anti-children. I mean, I think it's wonderful. I mean, I have a grandniece and nephew, a grandniece and nephew. And my mother is a great grandmother, which is, I have to say, is a wonderful thing when you have four generations living. But at the same time, I sit here going, how many more people do we need? But it ain't my choice. You know, nobody asked me, so I'll just sit over here and shut the hell up. But that's part of that process of finding someone, and I'm a big fan of country music, among other genres, but country music in particular. And some of those songs that I hear about that stereotype, I'm thinking, that's all you want? That's it? I mean, there, you must want more than that, you know. And I'm not saying that you have to do anything. My eldest sister, my late eldest sister, she pursued in her way her music career. She was a French hornist. I think that's correct. She actually made it to second chair in the Scottsdale Symphony Orchestra in Arizona. And I joke about this. The irony is that she had asthma. Who plays a wind instrument and has asthma? But it may have actually helped. I've actually learned that those kinds of things can help. But she pursued that. And her husband was, because my sister has passed. But he was on one level somewhat traditional, but the way he would describe their relationship, specifically at the memorial, he wasn't controlling. He let her be the person that she became. Just as my second oldest sister and her husband and my two younger sisters and their husbands. And they're all very happy. I'm still trying to figure out where my brother and I went wrong, because I'm divorced once and he's divorced twice. You know, Mike, find someone, you know, it's okay for the latter 50 years of your life, you know, or don't find anybody and just enjoy your retirement. He retired before I'm not retired, and he's already retired and he's younger than me. I don't understand that. But I find it interesting that in our family, which I guess on the one hand is sort of an anomaly, as I've sort of observed with other families and so forth that I've come in contact with, my parents let us be who we were to become. If we wanted their help, they were there for us, but they never interfered. They never stuck their nose in where it didn't belong or where it wasn't asked for. And and that's certainly not what you're doing here. You're saying, I'm just putting this out there, and we have this giant smorgasbord table. Each program adds another dish. You have just added another dish to that giant, the table gets longer and longer and longer. And we ask people to come and partake if it resonates with you. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're asking you folks to do now, is pick up a copy of Scarred. We hope that you will do that. Give us the website where people can go. I know that you have a website, which is, as I've mentioned before, drsaraswati. That's drsaraswati.com. You said, and it is available, I'm sure, through Amazon. Is it Audible yet? I guess that's really where I wanted to go.
No, it's not Audible yet. I think also this is, in some ways, as you mentioned, you use the word scholarly criticism. It is an academic book, but it is an academic book that is also partly a memoir. Mm-hmm. And so because it is an academic book, I do have to say that there are concepts, or people say big words, right, in the book. But that is partly my goal, is to kind of close the gap between the public and the academic. And what I did in my book is that every time I use quote unquote big word or this mm-hmm. concept or theory, I would then explain it. What is the definition and what is the example, like the day-to-day example of what that word means? And so for those of people who would like to, you know, try or not used to reading academic books and find them boring, hopefully you won't find this book boring in some mm-hmm. ways, because I do have that personal stories as well, like I said, the memoir part of it, and also the theory that is being explained. But I also wrote in the author's note in the book that if you find this, all the theory is just too much, and you don't want to read it, I said, okay, well then just, it's kind of like dip in, dip out. It's kind mm-hmm. of like mm-hmm. choose your own adventure kind of book, which is just, you can skip the big theory, that is fine too. And you can still learn something from the stories, mm-hmm. from the memoir part of the book. Because eventually, I think the four practices, and maybe I should, I know we only have a few more minutes, that I just go through it very, very quickly. Of the four practices that I talk about in the book can be applied, and need to be applied. I shouldn't say need, because then again, it's should. You should do this. And no, that's not what I'm saying. What I did say in my book is that here are the four things that I did. And I invite you to explore, take on your own journey and see what are your four things, what are your six things, what are your things that you can do in your life to live with pain. Because the goal is, if pain is here to stay, how can we live with it in a way that is more life nourishing for us, life sustaining, and also that is more social justice oriented. So the four practices is the first one is shifting the perception that I mentioned just now, just earlier. And the second thing is work with the body, but without the story. And what I mean by that, again, in the book, I talk more about like all of this, but in a nutshell, it is really about, can we cry without the story? Because when we cry, sometimes we're like, oh my God, why did I do that? Why me? And then we just go and go and go. And we like even create pain as we do that. And so what I suggest is that work with the body, because the pain is stored in the body. Emotional pain, physical pain, all kinds of pain, right? It stays in the body. So how can we resurface that pain and then transform that pain, but without the story? So that's the second thing. The third thing is to practice what I call feminist enchantment daily. And again, if the word feminist sort of scares you because of all of this misconception in the world, then just use the word enchantment. If enchantment is also like, oh my God, what does that even mean? Just use the word magic. And how can we create moments of magic in our daily lives? Every day, just one, at least just one moment, and that's enough. If you can create lots of them, great. But if not, just one. Why? Because a lot of the time we are made to feel defeated, right? Because of the pain, because we feel so much pain that we're like, you know what? I just want to give up. I don't want to live anymore. And when we have this one magical moment every day, it could be just watching the sunset. It could be like tasting the food that is so good that we forget our pain. We forget, you know, everything in our life and just like, wow. Right. And so that's the third practice. And the fourth practice is because, like I said, we also need to look beyond just the individual pain, but also the collective pain. So the fourth thing that I propose is that we need to democratize access to well-being. That means people should be able, when they have physical pain, let's say, they should be able to have access, to have, you know, whether to the doctor or to the medicine that they need and things like that, or when they need a therapist, then they would be able to afford that. Because even in our country, we don't have this sort of like affordable access to even mental health, right? We talk about it, but what are the support that we need, right? And so the fourth is not just about looking at ourselves, but looking at the collective and how can we make all of these things, all these programs and policies, there to support everyone, so that they can live with pain,
Well, I will
differently.
tell you that dives right into two of the lines from, I always get these mixed up, the preamble versus the declaration. Promoting the general welfare, it definitely flies in, goes into that category. But it cannot be separated from the next part, which is, and to preserve the blessings of liberty to ourselves and whom? Our posterity. And to me, that is referring to our collectiveness. And it seems as though we have gone considerably astray, you know? And it's really, to be honest with you, it's really kind of bizarre. That I hear people who are, you know, sort of that mindedness and talk about how, oh yes, I don't know, defend this document, so on. And yet, but you're missing these two lines here. Hello, come on, we need to band together again We need to get to, because to me, the last time that this country was unified in a constructive endeavor, it was not 9/11, okay? It goes back even further. I was 9 years old. And even though it was America, I love Neil Armstrong's comments about how he wasn't just there for the United States, he was there for all of humanity when he stepped off the limb. It's all of us. And I know he's not the only one who has said this, but it's in one of his songs where John Denver says it's all of us or none. If we don't sing as a chorus, we're all going to burn, is the phrase. So I love what you are talking about in this book. What I would like for you to share with us, as much as you are able to, but obviously you've revealed a great deal in the book, in the memoir section or the memoir parts, shall we say, you talk about pain. And if I can paraphrase this, in a manner of speaking, transforming pain into power. First of all, talk to us about pain, your pain, and what is this power you speak of, which I know you've already alluded to throughout the program here, but in this context, talk about the pain, your pain, and then the power, your power.
And so in the book, I talk about different kinds of pain. I talk about chronic illnesses that I have. I have Graves' disease, and I also have like back pain, which a lot of people, because we are sedentary and we like sit on front of the computer a lot of the time, we have all of this sort of physical pain. The chronic illnesses that I've experienced throughout life. And the other aspect of the pain that I talk about is also emotional pain. And the pain of, in the book, I specifically talk about the failures of my relationship and how that relates to my father and his own relationship, and how that in turn influences how I view my own sex and sexuality. So I talk about all this sort of like different range of pain in the book. I also do want to say that even though I say, yeah, there's this sort of emotional pain, yes, there is this sort of like physical pain, I do want to say that even though I say emotional pain, I can't really separate the emotional and the physical. And what I mean by that, let's say it's emotional pain. Let's say that your heart just got broken, right? The pain is also felt in the body, right? So we can't just say, oh, it's just emotional pain. No, because it like literally my body was aching, right? And so I just want to be clear on that, but I also talk about actual or like physical pain as well. And so what I mean when I said that, you know, I want to transform this pain, not to say that, again, like I said, it's not about it's all gone. It's like we never experience pain, because for as long as we live, there will all, you know, like we live. And pain is actually, and I talk about in the book, is an orienting tool. Pain tells us what is the problem, like what do we need to change? It could be physical pain. Then we need to realize, like, what do we need to eat? Maybe the environment is not healthy for us. Like, what do we need to change? And so pain can become, you know, in some way, this sort of like the tool or the alarm system that, okay, move away from those people, right? Move away from those kinds of relationships. These are causing you pain. So that's one, right? And so when I say that we need to transform that or transcend that, and then what happens then is what does it do for us, right? Again, it's not like, what can you do for me, you know, in that sense. But in the sense of what I just mentioned, which is about, oh, it is an orienting tool. Then we can go this way or that way. And also, pain becomes a lens, right, to see things. Because when I travel with my pain throughout all of these different countries, and when I think about my pain, it allows me to come up with these four practices. In other words, pain become power, become knowledge. Knowledge is power, and that's what I meant. Is that when I reflect on my pain, as I experience all my travel, I begin to see, Oh, it is about perception. It is about working with the body. It is about creating the magical moment in our life. It is about asking for access for everybody to have this kind of life with pain, but that is life sustaining. So that's what I mean by that. And also we have to remember that a lot of the time people use pain to control other, right? To gain power. And that's not what I talk about, obviously. I actually talk about to reclaim our power by creating these moments of enchantment, by creating these moments of, or like magical moments in our life, so that we can reclaim our power, so that we don't succumb to others' power. And those especially who try to control us by creating pain in our bodies, or like I said, emotionally or whatnot. But that's what bullies do, right? They say hurtful things because they control you. They want to like be more powerful than you are. But let's not let them do that, right? How can we allow power? I mean, sorry, how can we allow pain to be transcended or transformed into knowledge, into power, into having that energy to sustain our life?
Pain is energy and it will never go away, i.e., the energy will never go away. However, as we've been saying, you can transform that energy into, as you've just talked about, that power. One of the things too that I think, and this sort of ties in because you have a you also have, for example, on your website, you have information about meditation and spiritual practices and so forth. And one of the elements in reference to pain here, and listening to the pain, and this is where meditation would come in handy for anybody experiencing pain. As again, it's not to diminish the pain, it's going within and asking the question, what is this? What is the source of this pain? Not, oh, my knee hurts, that's the source. No. That's the symptom. That's the symptom. What's the source? Where does this come from? And is it an emotional? Is it an emotional trauma of greater or lesser extent that is causing this pain? I never really did that because I went to when I had my right knee, I had all kinds of pain for a week. I hated it because I couldn't walk. I mean, I love walking. We have a main street here in Santa Barbara. I don't know if in your town you have a main street, but I love walking it, and I could walk for 20 minutes and I'm at the beach, which is wonderful. But when my knee swells up and hurts like crazy, then I had it diagnosed. Oh, you got a torn meniscus on both sides. And I went in, arthroscopic surgery, boom, boom, boom. Next day, I was up and walking around, and I was not jumping yet, not jumping. But I think that's a real key as in terms of, knowledge is power. If you don't know your body, if you're not listening to your body, you're never going to know the reason why this particular pain is happening. A year after the pandemic was called, in July of 21, I was diagnosed with an infected, inflamed gallbladder with a golf ball size gallstone. And it just happened around the time of the Summer Olympics that year. So when it was all over, I said, oh yeah, I won a gold medal. Really? In what? The gallbladder clean and jerk. But I was also very aware, Phil, metaphysically, of the connection between not just the gallbladder, but also the liver and anger. And there would be times prior to that operation where I would spill milk, to use the example. Okay. After the gallbladder was removed, I was like, wow. And it wasn't necessarily anything I did consciously. And it really reaffirmed for me in this instance, oh yeah, the gallbladder is the seat of anger. That's good to get rid of that. Not that I never, because anger is part of who and what we are. And that's another aspect of this too that maybe we can touch upon real quickly here before we wrap up. And that is our emotions. I mean, we've touched upon it earlier, granted, but all of our emotions, And we can say the positive and negative, but I say, no, that's just our emotions are just our emotions. No labels, no judgment, no plus or minus. They are what make us who we are, just like all of our experiences. Talk to us about that in this context of SCARD and feminism and all the work that you do.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, all of my books that I've written touch upon emotions, or in particular, what they call the affect, or like the affect theory, which is about, so emotions has a social sort of construction or understanding to it. Like, we recognize it. But affect is more of that, you know, bodily shift. For example, we feel embarrassed and suddenly we feel our cheek like warm and red. And so that's what they call affect. And a lot of the times we do things without realizing that emotion is at the center of why we do what we do. So my first book, for example, is about beauty, and without us recognizing it. And again, I bring emotions or affect theory into that book because we put on this cream, sometimes knowing that this cream will not make you look young, right? But we do that to manage our emotions. Because of the anxiety, we see the wrinkle or whatever it is that we feel, and then we buy this cream and then we use it, whether or not it works or not. But at that moment, that is the emotion that we're trying to manage.
Right.
And so I think a life well lived, or you know, one that allows us to be blissful or content in some way, is to really look at how our emotion has guided the kind of choices that we make. And not to say that emotions are bad, not at all. Actually, I embrace emotions. I want to call all of the book, actually, I talk about emotions specifically because I want to include that to be part of our conversations, even in academia, because a lot of the time in academic setting, you have to be rational all the time, rational, rational, rational. Even in our daily lives, you have to be rational. Is that a rational decision? But the thing is, the rational cannot exist without the emotional, right? And so how can we really look at all of this and embrace all of that, right? Then we can really, really start making decisions that fulfills all of these aspects of our life, not just, well, this one, you know, gonna make me more money, or like, right? But will that also support that kind of like emotions, all kinds of emotions, the anger issues, the pain issues, or like whatever that is in our life?
You're rather prolific. You have quite a number of books out, not just SCARD. As you mentioned, you had another one as well. How many books have you written?
Five. And I know that we, there is another one that is co-edited with others as well, that hopefully are going to be approved soon. And it's going to, usually it hits the market like 2 years after it's being approved, because it takes 1 year of production and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, wonderful. And you're a young woman, and you've got five out. I am 64, almost 64, and I'm still working on my first.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
I know. I've learned that. It's a universal timing. You know, it's not mine. It's the universe's timing. Yeah.
I love another
quick question for you, and this is an observation on my part of your background. You have a big, wide open book there. On one page, a bunch of trees. On the other side, it's the Ace of Hearts. And inside the hearts, you've got some birds flying. Now, first of all, is that on the wall behind you, or is this a virtual image that we're looking at?
It is on the wall behind me. Yeah, that's
I love that. I would take it that there's more to it off to either side, or is that primarily for the purposes of these kinds of interviews?
So this is part, I have this is my dining room, and the dining room has a Alice in Wonderland kind of theme. And
oh,
so
cool.
Above it, there is the Mad Hatter hat, so to speak. So
that is very cool. I like that. My mother was the same way. Our dining room which had to seat eight, and it was not a big dining room either. She didn't necessarily paint on the wall, but she put up one of these beautiful nature murals. And I love when people do that. They get that creative and do that. We actually did that in a room of a house that I lived in, my wife and I lived in. And this particular room was very small. It wasn't more than maybe 5 or 6 feet by 6 feet. And it had four walls. And here's what was unique about it. Every single wall had a door. If you stood in that room and you turned one way and you opened one door, the garage, the door to the kitchen, the door into a bathroom, the door outside. I'd never seen a room like that before. And I just thought it was so cool. So we did. We put up one of these giant nature murals. So I love when people do that to make their space what the heck? I'm gonna say sacred, because that's kind of what it does, is it adds a specialness, if you will, to that. I'll ask you this final question before we wrap things up here. In terms of, as I mentioned at the front end of the program, our intuition, listening to that still small voice. For all of us, not just men, not just women, but for all of us, how important do you see that as far as really helping to, shall we say, propel us, move us forward in our transformational slash evolutionary process?
It is definitely very important. It is the second out of the four practices that I talk about in the book, which is working with the body, but without the story, right? And that without the story part is important because when we ask our body and then it gives you the answer, then we're like, really? I need to eat that today? That's what I'm thinking. Like, I'll eat ice cream instead. That's what I say to my body all the time, anyways. But it is very important. It is also very important to create that sort of quiet space and to learn how to quiet the mind, how to quiet all these other things. That's what I meant by when I said without the story, right? It is about quieting this all other things. And so to really ask the question and to listen, because when we have not practiced, it is very hard for us to even listen. When all of these chatter surrounding the answer, we can't even weed out what is the real answer. Is it this one? Is it that one? Right? And so to really, so we have to practice, practice, and practice. And soon we'll be able to do that. And even for those of us like you and I and a lot of people who have practiced, even I sometimes too still can't discern, is this the answer or is this the answer? Even though we've practiced a lot, right? And so let alone if we never practice, then it's going to be harder and harder. But definitely, I agree. Very important.
One of the wonderful exercises that I've been led to is in terms of quieting that chatter, is writing stuff down. Now, I'm not saying journaling per se, but there are things that we keep in our heads, and we think we try to prioritize. Oh, I need to do this, and I need to do that, and I need to get out a piece of paper. I've got this wonderful journal book that I've got, and I just started making a list, and I started out with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 13, 14, 15, 22, 23. I mean, it's like, but that's fine, because what I found was, and it was so extraordinary, was what was I just thinking? Where's my book? And I got to go back to the list, you know? And it's not like I really forgot, but it really quieted. It at least it toned it down to a lower decibel level, if you will, in my head. And I'm going, wow. You know, that is amazing. Have you come across that experience in, especially because you've written five books, and I'm sure there's a sixth and a seventh somewhere in there and more. But do you find that sometimes you have these ideas? And again, I know that's not your specific chosen path, but it's sort of an offshoot, a wonderful benefit from all that you do. Do you find that that's part of your process as well, where something comes and I'm write that down because I may want to use that, if not as a book, but in something that I'm working on, that kind of thing, or even a
Absolutely.
class.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Because when something comes, sometimes it comes as a sentence or like sentences, and it's the way that it's being delivered, right? So sometimes I cannot just get out of something. For example, I'm in the middle of driving, so I can't just like stop. If there is somewhere I can stop, then I would stop, and I would usually I have the notes in my cell phone. That's usually what I do. But if I just remember the main point, and then at home I sit down and try to like write it as a sentence the way that it was delivered earlier, it may not be the same. So when I hear something and it's delivered in a sentence, I try to write exactly how it was, because otherwise, I don't know, it's just I forget. I'm, how was it? It was just so perfect how it was being framed, how it was being delivered. So yeah, that's why as much as I can, write it down right away. Otherwise, who knows where it's going to go.
I've written a couple of songs myself, and I was driving one day, and I can't remember if it was shortly after my sister's passing a couple of years ago, and I'm coming down the mountain, coming down what we have is called the old San Marcos or the San Marcos Pass Highway 154, and I'm driving along, and I've got my phone there, but I'm not touching it, not doing anything with it, and all of a sudden these words come into my head, and I start verbalizing them with a melody and thinking, darn it, I can't do anything now because I'm driving. I can't even do anything with it. So sometimes those moments happen and you just aren't, you're not prepared, which is another good reason why you should be prepared as much as you can. So I've been working on my phone to audibilize everything. Hey, Google, open voice recorder or what have you. And so on and so, oh, guess what? I just activated the phone. And it's still taking down every word I say. Cut
That's so awesome. That's great.
I want to thank you so much for being here with us, Dr. Saraswati. It's been a joy. It really has. I've learned some of I've been reintroduced to some of the things that I have learned over the last, especially 25 years, but even before that. And this is just extraordinary. I encourage people to pick up a copy of your book, Scarred, and go to your website as well, drsaraswati.com. We'll be linked to that website. And I really appreciate what you are offering to the world, i.e., our listeners as well, to make this world a better place for everyone, not just a select few. That this world was not created just for a few people or individuals or a certain class. It's created for all of us. And thank you so much for your contribution.
And thank you so much for allowing me to share the space again. Thank you. You went through.
Before we go, I do have three final questions I ask all of my guests. But before I do that, I want to thank you for listening to and watching Tell Me Your Story. New paradigms for a new world where we're giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. We are here on Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m., Wednesdays at 9 a.m. with our special edition of Tell Me Your Story. And then Monday through Friday from 8 to 9 a.m., 9 programs, 9 guests, 9 topics, 9 opportunities to hear some new choices that maybe you hadn't thought of in a long time or never thought of before. And we encourage you to come to our smorgasbord table and partake. And by the way, we also stream at the times I've mentioned at richarddugan.com. We podcast all of these programs on SoundCloud, iTunes, TuneIn Radio, Spotify, Stitcher, Player FM, Blueberry, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, many other locations on the web. And I thank those who have been reposting the programs. Most appreciative for you doing that. We're also on YouTube where you can watch these conversations. We hope that you will subscribe as well as select notifications so that when a new conversation is posted, you'll be notified and you'll be able to tune into that conversation. We also ask if you can support the work that we are doing. You'd like to be a part of it financially and even energetically. We would appreciate that. We have a PayPal account. It is there for your security as well as ours. The email address you're going to want to input to send to is richard@richarddugan.com. And as we have already mentioned, please take the time during this, the decade of perfect vision, the 2020s, and go within to that quiet, peaceful, calm, still place and listen to that still, small voice. Oh, and remember this, that 99% of the time, the questions that you are asking, the answer is in the question. I don't know who said that. I've read it somewhere. but I believe it is true that the answer to your question is actually in the question. So take that time during the 2020s, the decade of perfect vision. With all of that being said, I would like to ask our very special guest here on the program to share with us answers to these following questions, the first of which is, who is Ayu Saraswati?
It's a non-self. I think that's the better answer in some ways, because I think I've learned about anatta in Buddhism. It's about the non-self, that there is no self. And so what I try to do is I just allow myself to be kind of, I don't know if the word vessel is the word for it, but allows, like what we talked about, you know, ideas to come through me and things like that. And I try to always sort of like challenge the ego. And so it's not about, this is what Ayu Saraswati should be, but it's sort of like, it's the non-self. It keeps changing. It keeps sort of transforming into a new being. So that would be my answer, my final answer.
Would you like to make a phone call? Get some help on that one. No. What is it that gets you up in the morning?
I think it's the magic. It's the magic of the day, looking forward to like what is going to unfold in the day. I really look forward to seeing what surprises that the universe will bring me for that day, because it is true. When I look at my life, right now, this was not something that I had even imagined it to be, but here we are. And so it's always sort of just like, what is the moment, and what is the magical moment that is going to happen today? Mm-hmm. And so I wake up and I would be saying, well, thank you for a wonderful day. That would be like what I usually say after I wake up, the first thing. So I'm just excited about how the day will unfold. Sometimes it involves writing, sometimes it involves teaching, sometimes it involves meeting new friends, but it's in that possibility, in it kind of like a gift, like a surprise gift every day. And so I'm kind of like, what does the universe have for me today, kind of thing.
And speaking of what the universe has for you in a given day, what was your best day?
That's hard. That's hard because I've had lots of them. So to choose one, that would be hard. But I think like one of the days that I really, really love is when I get to spend time with my family. And because like, we are part of a diaspora sort of family. And so I have my parents living somewhere, I have my sister living somewhere else, I have my brother. And so during certain like, quite rare moments when we could be like all together, like my sister just celebrated her birthday last year. I'm not gonna say the number because I don't know if she wants people to know her age, but that's sort of like, you know, one of those big number. Mm-hmm. And so there was everybody, and that was just like, wow, the ability to just laugh together and be with one another, and we all love food. And so a good day, the best day always involves really, really delicious food.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Couldn't agree with you more on that one. My mother's always been a great cook. My grandmother on her side, made some of the greatest tamales. I miss those. Anyway, thank you so much for joining us here on the program. It has been a great pleasure, and I hope that we can have you back again when this other compendium comes out.
Thank you again so much. Have a beautiful day to you.
And thank you. And thank you for listening to and watching Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. And until our next broadcast, podcast, videocast, love to Lal. Jeanette, I am still listening. Dad, continue to be happy because I am. Smokey, I'll see you on the other side. And to my dear friend, Zorro, aho, aho.